Grandpa and Grandma's intimate life is almost purely a matter of conjecture. It's a safe bet that it's not conjectured often. Grandpa calls Grandma dearie. And if Grandma calls Grandpa anything, no one knows, because it's all on her fingers, because of his deafness. It's obvious that Grandpa feels tenderly toward Grandma and that she loves him. But she often gets impatient. Grandpa writes to Ronald, his son, from the West, where he and Grandma are visiting another son, Trevor, and his family. Quote, "When little Carla sees Mother talking to me by hand, she grows belligerent. She seems to think Mother is going to hurt me. I think because Mother emphasizes so vividly, she thinks Mother is scolding me. Well, I think so sometimes myself." And on the farm, when Grandma gets all bothered toward Grandpa and is carrying on with heat and passion, Grandpa, with a quizzical little smile, will reach out a cautious finger, touch her knee, and say, "S-s-s-s-s." And that usually stops Grandma short and makes her laugh. All her life, she saved Grandpa's first letter, November of 1894, which contains this evocative paragraph. "I have lived over again and again our summer at the camp. You know how much I said about forgetting the company as soon as we were separated. Well, I have changed my opinion. I have noticed that those I became attached to have been growing dearer to me. You know, too, that one of the reasons of postponing our correspondence was to test the genuineness of our affection for each other. Now, my dear girl, let me assure you that my affection for you has only deepened since our separation. We will not dwell on the events of the summer, for when I begin recalling them, the stream of thought is endless. There is one psychological phenomenon well illustrated in my thoughts of Geneva, that is, that when we call up past experiences, those that have impressed you most deeply at the time will be the first called up. When I think of our parting, I do not think of the last trip over to Williams Bay as the last parting, but rather the trip over on that foggy morning and our parting on the beach. Do you remember?" He ends the letter with the request that they exchange photographs and signs it with an astonishing "Love and Kisses." Grandma also saves the letters Grandpa writes her when she's away for several weeks in the summer of 1914. These usually start, "My precious dearie," and along with news contain such lines as, "Everything is moving nicely this morning, but I do miss you. I was very lonesome last night. The cubbies are lots of company to me and full of fun. Was sorry I got down out of the peak of the barn too late to bid you goodbye. And I am sorry you did not get my love letters while you were at Camp Byron. I have written to you every day. And your nice love letters do me lots of good. I miss you so much. I cannot tell you all you are to me. Tonight my legs and arms are tired and nervous. I would just like to be with my strong, sweet wife. She rests and consoles me." Grandma saves the letters, too, that Grandpa writes daily in 1915, during the weeks that he travels around the state with Professor Otis, giving seminars on farm management. Quote, "I know my dearie is thinking of me a great deal today, and I am of her. I know she felt badly to have me so busy last night and to leave as I had to. And I love you so today, I would give anything to see you for a little while. And now a little love letter to your own self. I think of you with your anxiety and care for the cubbies and high ideals for the whole home life. I want to live up to my opportunity and be worthy of such a helpmate. Your loving Wes. And I am a little homesick tonight. I would like to be with you. Tell the cubbies to keep the envelopes, and when I get home, we will make a journey book from them. You precious wife. I do love you more and more, and I will try my best to be all you deserve. Must close and work on data. Your loving husband, W.J. Dogan. There are also some letters from Grandpa and Grandma's old age. One is an anniversary letter from Grandpa, when both are in their mid-70s. This note to remind you that you are as dear to me today as you were the day we stood on the little bridge and I placed the small diamond on your finger, or the autumn day we started our long journey of life together. It has always been a marvel to me that you had the faith in me and the courage to cast your lot with me. We have met the changing scenes and vicissitudes of life together and surmounted disappointments and difficulties. Also garnered the joys and satisfactions of fellowship and service. I've always regretted your losing the diamond, but it was not a break in our love and devotion to each other. Today, as a token of this sustaining love, I want to take you to Mr. Brill's and have you choose another diamond, bigger and better than the first one, for our love is sealed with 45 years of experience. Your devoted husband, W.J.D. Grandpa himself saves Grandma's appreciative response to his letter and gift. In it, she apologizes for her impatience. I don't mean anything when you can't get my message over the first time. Only, it is an effort when I am feeling run down to repeat a long sentence. Think nothing of it. I love you more than I can tell. I dread the time when we have to be separated. I like to be in your presence more than anybody else's. So know, as we grow older, I love you more and more, and you are dearer and dearer to me. Affectionately, your dearie. 3 years later, when Grandma is in a Madison hospital for tests, Grandpa writes her every day, describing the new trucks painted and lettered, the golden bantam sweet corn he's planted at Ron's place, and Effie's care for him. Effie is Grandma's spinster niece who keeps house for Grandma and Grandpa. I stopped for breakfast. It was splendid, asparagus on toast, fit for the king, and the king got it. He ends his letters with how he thinks of her every hour and the usual love that has grown with the years. One, in its closing, echoes the "Do you remember?" of his first letter. He signs it, "Yours," and adds, after his WJD, "I underline it. You know the rest." A few things not contained in letters are known of Grandma and Grandpa's intimate life. Grandma occasionally speaks on this subject to her next-door neighbor down the road, Mrs. Smith, who is Eloise Marston's grandmother. Eloise, always quietly around, tunes in to adult conversations and stows them away for future pondering. At a young age, she hears of Eunice's many miscarriages that lead to the bringing of Esther from the Sparta orphanage to be the daughter that's missing in the family and to become her good chum. And later she learns that as soon as Eunice enters menopause, she moves out of Grandpa's bedroom into the adjoining one, telling Mrs. Smith, "Well, there's no point in doing it once you're in the change, since the only reason you do it is to have a baby. And that would be wonderful, of course. But once you're in the change, all that's over." Mrs. Smith's expression lets Eloise know that her grandmother doesn't agree with Mrs. Dogan. But Mrs. Smith stays silent, and Eunice doesn't notice. Later yet, she hears Eunice tell her grandmother about a several-day conference she's returned from. She'd gone along with Grandpa, who was the main speaker, to write and spell to him what was taking place. "And would you know, we were given a room with a double bed." "Well, that really distressed me. But there was nothing we could do about it. We had to share the bed. But you know, Wesson kept himself so nice and clean. He was so nice and tender toward me. that it wasn't bad. This time, Mrs. Smith doesn't hold her tongue. Well, of course it wasn't bad, she retorts. Jackie, growing up in a boisterous household of sisters and brother, is for a long time unaware of adult sexual life. At the little house, mother and daddy gather on the sleeping porch. But she and Craig sleep together in the next room. And Joan and Patsy sleep together in the third bedroom across the hall. It's a matter of space. Grandpa and Grandma, with all the space of the big house, of course, have separate bedrooms. Besides, Grandpa snores. The subject comes up when Jackie is more savvy about things, in her later teens. Mother says, Gram told me that she and Gramp never had intercourse except to have children. I always felt so sorry for Grandpa. When Jackie hears this, she does too. It seems mean of Grandma, no matter how she herself feels, to deny patient, loving Grandpa. Mother also tells how Grandma said to her once, over at the little house, how disgusted she was when she'd be changing the sheets of the young hired men at the big house and find them wet. Mother says, I said to her, you should approve. It shows they haven't been tomcatting around. The topic of her grandparents' sex life doesn't surface again till years later. Jackie brings it up. By then, she's read enough and learned enough to realize many of the forces that shaped both Grandma and Grandpa when they were growing up. First, from their births around 1870 to their marriage in 1898 and their subsequent life together. Both were children during the repressive Victorian era. Both would have been protected from its hidden excesses. In addition, both were raised to strict Methodist households. Drinking, smoking, and gambling were the sins that were preached about. Desecrating the Sabbath was a pretty big sin, too. But the undiscussed biggest sin was sexual sinning. In all her years, squirming in the long wooden pew in the Methodist church, Jackie never heard a sermon that mentioned sex in any way. If it was referred to, the reference was so oblique that she missed it. There was no public mention of sex at all, much less sex as a normal part of married life, a joy to the couple, a bond to the relationship. So if there was still this taboo, two generations after Grandma and Grandpa's childhood, could they even have talked about it? Daddy, who is in on the later conversation with Mother and Jackie, says he can't remember any birds and bees lecture from either parent, though Grandma's letters to him at college are full of exhortations to stay pure. I assumed she meant smoking, though. Nobody ever mentioned sex. But there's always so much sex on a farm that you never needed to be told anything. You could see the birds and the bees, the chickens and the pigs, and your regular trip taking the cow to the bull. Farm is a synonym for sex. You told me, says Mother, that your father told you when you went off to Northwestern that sex was a sacred and blessed thing given by God to have children and to procreate the world. Did I? Says Daddy. And you told me that when you went off to France, Grandpa said to you that before he and your mother went to bed together, they'd kneel down and pray at the bedside and ask the Lord to bless their union with children. Did I? Says Daddy. Well, now you take me, I just hung my pants on the bedpost, and those four children came from somewhere. And Grandpa always loved children, wanted a family, Mother persists. Jackie says, So I'm thinking that the same taboos affected Grandpa as affected Grandma. He must have been at least a little responsible for any lack of sex in his later years. It wasn't just the snoring. Daddy says, and I'm thinking of the old story of the census taker, who asks the German woman how many children she has. 6 boys, says the woman. Oh, every time a boy, says the census taker. Ah, no, says the woman, thousands of times and nothing.